people who learn languages by the dozens in search of hyperpolyglots. How many languages do you speak? I'm Keith Shortall, and today we'll learn about polyglots, those who can speak several languages, and hyperpolyglots, those who claim fluency in a dozen or more tongues. We all start by learning one language, and some of us can speak two, maybe three. But throughout history, there are stories of individuals who can speak, read, and write 20, 30, even as many as 72 different languages. Portland author Michael Erard does not consider himself a hyperpolyglot. Instead, he calls himself a monolinguist with benefits. He speaks some Chinese and some Spanish. In his new book, Babble No More, The Search for the World's Most Extraordinary Language Learners, Erard travels the world and searches the history books to try and find out why some of us have a remarkable aptitude for language. This is Maine Calling. For some, learning a second or third language is no big deal. For others, mastering one language can be a challenge. Michael Erard has graduate degrees in linguistics and rhetoric from the University of Texas at Austin. He's written about language and linguistics for Slate, Wired, The Atlantic, and The New York Times, among other publications. He's the author of one other book, Slips, Stumbles, and Verbal Blunders, and What They Mean. He joins me in the studio to talk about his new book and what he's learned about hyperpolyglots and learning to speak foreign languages. Also in the studio with us, Connor McDonough Quinn. He's a polyglot from right here in Portland. We want to hear from you. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Send us a tweet at Maine Calling. Post a comment or question on our Facebook page or email to talk@mpbn.net. Michael Erard, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What was the idea behind this book?
The idea was to really go in search of the person that you could say was the person who spoke the most languages ever in the world, and also to answer the question of what are the upper limits of the ability to learn and speak and use different languages.
Is the difference between a polyglot and a hyperpolyglot just the number of languages they seek to learn?
I think it's partly about number of languages, but also the way that they use them. Hyperpolyglots are distinguished in a couple of ways from the polyglot or the multilingual. One is that they keep a large number of languages kind of on ice that are surge languages that they don't have active that they would need to spin up before they were able to use them. The polyglot, I think, is someone who is more actively using a number of languages in everyday life.
The book kind of chronicles your search for some of these historical characters that legend had it were remarkable multilinguists, including a character named Giuseppe Mezzofanti. Who is he? When did he live? And why is he important?
So any conversation about hyperpolyglots really starts with Giuseppe Mezzofanti, who was an Italian cardinal born in Bologna, ended up in Rome, elevated to cardinal. He was born in 1774, died in the middle of the 19th century. And, you know, I think now when we think of massive multilinguals, people maybe think of C-3PO, the robot from Star Wars who speaks 6 million languages. But in the 19th century, it really was Mezzofanti who became very widely known far and wide in the Americas and Europe for speaking any number of languages, and the number varies depending on who you talk to. Some give the number 72, some say 60, 61, some say that he mastered 30 languages. And I went to Bologna, Italy to look into his archives and see if there was anything there that would shed some light on what he was actually able to do.
You were working kind of as a history detective, trying to verify whether he truly was this amazing figure or how amazing he was. Was there something surprising that you found out about him in terms of how he managed to do this?
Yeah, there were a number of things that I found in the archives that had never been described before. One of them was a very interesting legal document about the disinterment of his body about 40 years after he died, which apparently was the first move in trying to get him canonized. The other interesting thing, or one of the other interesting things that I found in the archive, was a box that was full of slips of paper organized by language, seemingly, that had one word in one language written on one side and a word or a string of words written in what looked like Italian. And I realized, opening the box immediately, that this was Mezzafanti's flashcards.
So was it possible that he was simply using the same techniques that many, you know, fledgling language learners use today?
That was probably one of the things that he had in his basket of methods. He was also someone who sought out native speakers wherever he could find them. He would go to hotels to find native speakers of languages. He worked as a nurse in some hospitals and learned languages in order to aid wounded soldiers. There were some Napoleonic era battles that took place in and around Bologna, and he took full advantage of that sort of access.
Talk a little bit about the rest of the history also of polyglottery, because there is a sort of connection to the evangelical mission of Christianity.
Yeah, so polyglottery or hyperpolyglottery really seems to be a phenomenon that's doesn't happen much outside the West and much outside Europe, and it's linked to the history of Christianity. The Christianity is, though we like to think that Jesus spoke English, he probably was trilingual himself, and the founding texts of Christianity were not written in a single language like the Quran was. So it required translators, and it required people who were knowledgeable in a number of languages to go back and try to find some original language that was shrouded in mystery. And that's where you get scholars, particularly in the church, who were like Mezzafanti, learning a lot of languages in order to be able to encounter the divine ultimately in these divinely revealed texts.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation today. Would you say that there are some languages that are inherently more difficult than other languages? And more specifically, is there a language that is generally accepted to be, you know, the most difficult to learn?
That's an interesting question. You know, it depends a lot on what your mother tongue is and the sorts of structures that it gives you and the sort of sounds that it has. So, you know, we might say that the hardest language to learn is somehow the furthest one, however you would measure that distance from your mother tongue. Other people like to say that the hardest language to learn is the one that you're not motivated to learn. So make it – it's in that sense, it's purely a matter of motivation. But, you know, there are some little languages that are used purely in scientific experiments that are actually quite hard to learn. They're designed specifically to be hard to learn. They do some things that normal human languages don't do, and people have – quite a hard time learning those languages.
Because we often hear in the West, we hear about the sort of the difficulty of Chinese, you know, memorizing the characters. And
yeah.
Would that be on the list?
Literacy would definitely be on the list. But the grammar of Chinese, of Mandarin, is actually fairly simple. And it's a language that will seem very familiar to native English speakers because both languages are ones that rely on word order quite a lot.
So when we're talking about someone, you know, being proficient, I guess is one word to describe it in a language, does that mean that they can, you know, have a conversation, read and write, I think in your book you talk about being able to respond instantly in an emergency is a good test.
Yeah. You know, there's lots of different standards for this and lots of different, you know, it depends on who's asking the question and what's at stake. So a school or a business or a government would have one way of measuring that, which would be very different from people in their ordinary lives. You know, I did research in South India where people consider themselves multilinguals and will say, yeah, I speak some language because they do things in their lives. They're never tested. They're not literate. But they would certainly say, yes, I speak language X.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. You talked about, you said earlier that the one of the hardest languages to learn are those that you aren't motivated to learn. In the case of hyperpolyglots, what is the motivation? Are they showing off? Are they fascinated with other languages? Or are they addicted to learning?
So some of the negative rap on the hyperpolyglots, and I think this is some of the reason why they haven't really been studied by scientists, is that they are collecting trophies, that they want to – that there's a kind of geek macho to having a big number that you whip out at cocktail parties and impress people. But I really didn't find that to be the case. I found that these were people who were fascinated with learning, and addiction maybe is a strong word. One of the characters that I meet in the book, he described himself as addicted to language – to languages. But, you know, these are people for whom this – doing this kind of work, this sort of activity makes their brains feel good. And so they pursue it. And because it feels good, they do it a lot and get better at it.
Let's bring in Connor McDonough Quinn, a polyglot sitting here with us before us. Connor, what is it that I guess excites you or compels you to learn languages?
Well, I do think that what Michael said, it definitely holds for my particular case. I've just, ever since I discovered foreign language learning in my early teens, it was just really, really fun. I mean, I come from a family where we like learning new vocabulary even in English. And so I think it was the opportunity to realize that you could just learn an endless amount of fun new words that words and modes of expression. But I think there is just sort of a particular kind of brain pleasure, you know, the same way that I think someone who learns a musical instrument always wants to learn more songs. They want to do new and more things with this system that they have some command of.
How many languages do you know, or would you say that you are?
Well, I think, you know, I think one of the great things about Michael's book is it points out that it makes clear how complex the question of, you know, how many languages you speak. If you speak a bunch of languages perfectly fluently or quite thoroughly fluently and can do all kinds of things, then you can easily rattle off 3 or 4 or 5 and say, that's how many I speak. But if you like learning new languages, and that's definitely where I'm at, I almost can't even answer the question reasonably. I can tell you that, for example, that Indonesian and Mandarin are my two best languages, and I can speak in both of those languages fairly comfortably, especially if I've been using them a lot. And then Irish Gaelic I studied for a long time. My professional work is with Penobscot and Passamaquoddy Maliseet, so I'm hopefully reasonably competent in those. And I've worked in Somali but haven't used it in a long time. So so a lot of it is well, they're all in various degrees of rustiness
right.
is the fair answer.
Yeah.
I mean, I could tell you the languages I've studied, and that would go on for a really long time.
Okay.
But it wouldn't – and it sounds impressive, but it would be more impressive if I actually knew them all fluently.
Right. We have a tweet from a listener, and I suspect we're going to hear from other listeners asking the same question. So we'll do it right now, which is, you know, how can a 60-year-old monoglot, our tweeter writes, become a polyglot? What's the fastest and best way to learn? Connor, why don't we start with you?
Okay. Well, I haven't yet learned what it's like to be 60 years old. but I would say that even in my advanced age of 33, what makes the most difference in language learning, I find, being able to function in a language, is a mixture of two components. One is, more than anything else, is not the mechanical, not the grammar and the pronunciation, but actually what I always think of as psychosocial. Like it's your own attitude and the way you approach the task and the way you deal with your fears of looking bad or embarrassing yourself or just the general discomfort of being a full-grown adult who's somehow reduced to less than a child in their ability to express themselves. How you deal with that, if you sort of jump on that and say, yay, now's my chance to be, you know, kind of a clown or a fool and a kid, or at the very least you take a different attitude towards the mistakes you make. You attend to them, you notice them, you try to improve them, but you don't let them worry you and hold you back. You take it as part of the process. That's more than anything else. That sort of state of mind, a sort of optimistic and happy, happy-go-lucky approach has always worked for me.
Michael Erard, you write about hippos, this sort of club, I guess, or organization in your book, which I guess subscribes to this belief that it's best to return to sort of a state of childhood when learning a new language, to learn like a child. Is that close to accurate?
Yeah. The notion is that the childlikeness is probably this one of the states that Connor was just describing, and that adults can return to that. It's a club for families, and families go play games, sing songs, dance dances. It's also a kind of language karaoke where there are preset speeches that people learn how to give to the group, and everyone supports everyone else's efforts. So there are no tests. There's no criticisms. It's very fun. They don't you know, their claim is that anyone can speak seven languages.
Hmm.
I didn't among my travels with the hippos, I did not actually meet anyone who could speak seven languages. And I spent some time in Massachusetts with the group, and also with a group in Chihuahua City, Mexico.
Seven it seems somewhat arbitrary number, but is that, had they measured this somehow?
I don't know quite where the number seven comes from. You know, there are a couple, you know, there are numbers that get thrown around with that have mystical significances. So saying that Mazzafanti had 72 languages is supposed, you know, 72 is supposedly the number of languages that were created at the Tower of Babel. You'll see repeated too that a lot of hyperpolyglots will take 2 weeks to learn a new language, not three, not one. Two seems to be an amount of time that is fantastically short, but not ridiculously short.
Quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. Send us an email, talk@mpbn.net, tweet @MaineCalling, or post a comment on our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Detroit wants to turn your car into a rolling internet connection. We'll look at cars as the web on wheels. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
You can join us for On Point this evening at midnight. And don't forget, you can join us for the On Point weekly wrap-up Fridays at 7 p.m. Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listener contributions and by Maine Senior Guide, a statewide online resource for senior products, services, and information in Maine, online at maineseniorguide.com. Join us this afternoon at 2 o'clock for the Diane Rehm Show as she discusses the role of private equity firms in the U.S. economy. GOP presidential frontrunner Mitt Romney says he's been a job creator. Opponents argue he was a corporate raider. Diane and her panel will examine the role of private equity firms in the U.S. economy this afternoon at 2 o'clock.
And welcome back. This is MPBN. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we're talking languages, learning lots and lots of languages. Join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, email talk@mpbn.net, tweet @MaineCalling, or post a comment or question on our Facebook page. Michael Erard, I'm sure we're going to get this question also, which is it a good idea in your view, or is there any proof that it's a good idea to teach kids language, multiple languages, when they're very young, or to begin when they're very young? And how complex should those lessons be?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The earlier the better. You know, I don't know if it's better to be teaching three or four languages earlier, you know, but certainly there are children who grow up in trilingual, quadrilingual circumstances all over the world, and they keep those things sorted in their brains and develop quite well. I was talking with someone yesterday who was thinking about getting his six-year-old in a private school that was going to cost $20,000 a year because it was a Spanish bilingual school, but they might be considering moving after that. And I said, you know, you're going to be spending a lot of money and you're going to be giving her an advantage, but the fact that she has a brain that is very plastic and moldable, she can learn things very easily, it also means that she can forget things very easily. Mm. That's kind of the downside of plasticity. And so if you spend, you know, $60,000 with her in 3 years of school and then you move away, you run the risk that that she'll forget that language. And that's something that people need to keep in mind, that it's, you know, it requires maintenance over time, and solving that problem is, for Americans particularly, is the hard one to solve.
Connor, did you start young?
No. I think the earliest time I really started putting any time into learning language counts as somewhat young, but by general linguistic standards, too old, which is age 12. I had French in middle school a bit, but I got really interested in Irish Gaelic. That was really the first foreign language I, of my own accord, went off and studied. A name like Connor McDonough Quinn, you can understand why.
I guessed. I didn't want to assume anything.
I think one of the things about language maintenance and language learning is languages are actually quite cheap. And to learn and maintain them it depends on how you learn them. To give a kid an environment where they learn a language, the best thing is to take them to the environment and have them plunk them down there, and that'll kind of do it. What it takes to maintain them afterwards also depends on how much they got in the first place, I think.
Let's take a call. Let's go to John in North Turner. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi.
I had a question relative to the age question, or the suitable age, and a second question that's related to that. First of all, everything I read indicates that by the age of 25, your ability to learn a new language is sadly declined. I was wondering, first of all, whether the Italian polyglot you featured, you talked about earlier, learned all of his language at a relatively young age, or whether he continued learning languages all his life. Related to that question is the second, whether anyone understands this extreme ability in terms of, say, Chomsky's universal grammar theory. For example, would an accomplished polyglot be able to tap into that universal grammar, whereas those multitudes, probably like me, who find it difficult to learn a language, are unable to tap into that? And that's where the difference lies.
All right, let's go to our guests. First of all, I guess Mezzofanti was quite young.
He was young when he started, and I think the languages that he had the most proficiency with were the ones that he had started very early and so had the most practice with over the course of his life. But he continued to learn them up until the time that he died. Someone else I discuss in the book is a Hungarian translator named Lom Kato, who was famous, and I say she only spoke 17 languages, and that makes people laugh. But she was learning her 17th language, which was Hebrew, in her 80s. So it's possible to continue, you know, there are different parts of language that drop away and that become much harder. I think this is a contribution of the book, actually, because the hyperpolyglot kind of licenses us to think beyond native-like and becoming a native speaker. So if you hold a goal that's not becoming a native speaker, you'll have an easier time and you'll actually be able to achieve something in your language.
His second part of his question was about universal grammar.
Yeah, so, you know, I should let I'm going to let Connor take that, actually.
All of my professional educational training has been in linguistics, which is surprisingly not necessarily what you find with that many people who are polyglots or hyperpolyglots. I would say, based on reading your book, the majority of people you met were not linguists, and few of them were like academically trained professional linguists, unlike myself. I went and majored in linguistics because I really liked learning languages, and it was something of a shock to discover that a lot of the linguistics world, you know, you're definitely going to meet more polyglots in linguistics than in other fields, for sure. But a lot of the field has a very different take on language, and that's their goal is not to learn lots and lots of languages. It's this sort of refrain of linguists when they are introduced themselves that they have to explain to the person, I'm a linguist, but no, I don't speak five languages. And it was always a bit odd for me as a linguist because, you know, that is kind of what I do. the reason I bring that up is because linguists are the mainstream of linguistics currently is focused on universal grammar and that notion that we all have sort of an underlying language capacity. that feeds is the foundation for our specific languages. And the question being, you know, can hyperpolyglots tap into that directly? I think we all do, obviously, to speak the languages we do in the first place. But as a, it's definitely been the case for me as someone who loves learning languages but also has training in that theory, that model, and the model of how languages work. I apply that all the time to my efforts to learn new languages. And so – but tapping into that is not some kind of, you know, instinctual special gift. It's just I have studied linguistics a lot and think an awful lot about how languages are structured and how they work. And the, over the years and years, you know, what you need to know about them in order to get a functional capacity in them gets simpler and simpler, I find.
We have one person who is writing in. It must be an email saying she speaks four languages and says the real test is if you can get the jokes. Is humor a good measure of understanding a language?
Sure, that would be one measure. Connor mentioned yesterday when we were talking the ability to eavesdrop on someone else's two people that you do not know. Their conversation and make sense of it. That's also very hard and very difficult.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. I want to talk about the case of Christopher in your book, who is who's a brain damaged person who relatively low IQ, but has this incredible capacity to learn languages quickly.
Mm-hmm.
How much does that case suggest that the sort of ability to that memory or memorization is an important factor in learning languages?
Yeah, he's a really interesting case in the scientific literature and really virtually the only single person who has been considered by linguists as being interesting. And it's not so much because he has a lot of languages from their perspective, but that he can do this, but he also has the damaged cognitive abilities. So linguists want to prove or demonstrate that language is separate from in the brain, from other cognitive abilities, and Christopher is an example of that. Now, most linguistic models, probably virtually all of them, don't have a place for memory or memory systems. So Christopher does present a challenge, I think, to that. Clearly, what the thing that he has is an incredible memory, not just in terms of how much he's able to learn very quickly and how much he can retain, but there are some interesting other features of it. I think, for instance, that he remembers things more if he looks at them less.
Wow, that would be a great trait to be able to, for all of
like
us to have.
Yeah, that superpower. Yeah.
Right, exactly. 1-800-399-3566. Let's take another call from Tom in Harpswell. Hi, Tom.
Hi. From my studies years ago in the International Phonetics Alphabet, I recall there were something like 52 phonemes, that is to say, discrete sounds, made by all human language, and that any given language only uses a portion of those. One of the sounds has to do with phonation or voicing while you breathe in, that is to say, inhalating rather than exhaling.
Can you do that?
German and the Scandinavian women say, yeah. And Maine men say, yeah.
Yeah. My mother, who was both a Scandinavian and from Maine, did that and said, for emphasis, it was
The great thing about linguists is that we love languages. I think all of us do, and what we really like to do is make up new terminology. So, like that type, those types of sounds are called pulmonic ingressives.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. Another word to learn. Another two words to learn. Yeah. It makes linguists happy, but when you read it, to open up a textbook to learn a new language, and they're like, and now we'll learn pulmonic ingressive sounds, when you're just trying to speak a language, it can be a bit of a barrier.
Yeah. There's some other interesting, just sort of quirky elements in your book where you discover, for example, that a person who is, psychotic or hears voices when sort of using one language, when they change to another language that they're familiar with,
that goes away. The voices go away, or they seem less the problem seems less dramatic.
Yeah, those were some really interesting cases of polyglot psychotics, where people would be disordered in one language and then perfectly sane in another. And that was I mentioned that in the book as a way of, you know, perhaps that could be a method for maybe a lesser known method for distinguishing the languages that someone really speaks, you know, versus the ones that someone merely, I say merely, but someone talks in or has less abilities in.
Would you challenge the conventional wisdom that people think in a language? So in other words, I know that I really understand Russian now because I'm starting to think and dream in Russian.
Yeah. You know, I think linguists say now, you know, we don't think in a language. The language is really just kind of a method for translating brain activity to the external world. And that feeling when you're learning a new language of being able to think in the new language is those patterns are becoming more automatic. So you're not having to rely on your mother tongue. You're not having to pre-rehearse things in your head. So it feels like it's coming much more quickly. And we associate that sort of speed and that sort of fluidity with thinking. And I think that's where that sense comes from, that, oh, I'm thinking in Russian now, or you got to think in Russian, don't think in English. Yeah.
Connor, do you have an experience that is like thinking?
Yeah, what I would say is I think even though I also agree, I think we don't think in any particular language. But one thing we often do, especially as adults, and this may be one of the reasons why kids are a bit better at learning languages than adults, besides this sort of biological plasticity, is that as adults with responsibilities and things we have to go do, we have to think about that happened in the past and go do in the future, we have to do a lot of planning. And I think a lot of times we talk to ourselves in our mind. We have an internal monologue where we plan things out. And that comes very close to almost spoken language. And, you know, using very explicit logic, you know, there's a reason why logos and logic are etymologically related. So I think there's a way in which, especially as adults, we talk to ourselves almost out loud in our minds.
All right, yeah. We're going to take a quick break. And when we return, more of your comments and questions. Stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
It's been 20 years since Maine overhauled its workers' compensation system, and some believe it is now time to change the system again. This week on Maine Watch, we'll look at the workers' comp reform bill before the legislature, and we'll find out why organized labor is so opposed to it. Our guests, Representative Andre Cushing, who authored the bill, Jim Case, counsel for the AFL-CIO, and Workers' Compensation Board Paul Signolfi. We hope you'll join us.
And you can join us for Maine Watch tonight at 8 and tomorrow at 9 on MPBN television, or tomorrow afternoon at 12:30 right here on MPBN radio. In the weather, today snow will spread to the rest of the state by dusk. Along the coast and south of Route 1 from Brunswick to Ellsworth and Eastport, expect 3 to 5 inches of snow before a change to rain. Throughout the interior, south of Bangor to Bethel, snow will blend with sleet and then to freezing rain with 5 to 9 inches likely before the change. Temperatures overnight mid-teens north, mid-30s south. Tonight, snow continues over the northern third of the state with 2 to 4 inches. The remainder of the state will see periodic freezing mist, while winds will ease statewide. Overnight, temperatures mid-teens north, near 30 south, mid-30s near the shoreline.
And welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to the Maine Public Broadcasting Network. Today on the program, learning languages. Share your thoughts. Call 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net. Post to our Facebook page or send us a tweet at Maine Calling. And let's go to South Berwick and Ingrid. Hi, Ingrid.
Good morning. Well, good afternoon, actually. My question has to do with my interest in the brain and how the brain works. And I was wondering, I guess I was thinking more if learning a language becomes easier with each new language that you learn, since the neural pathways maybe are more ready or firing more, and if there's been any brain research done with language acquisition and brain research.
Mm-hmm. There's quite a lot of brain research that's described in the book, although it's more along the lines of trying to ascertain the degree to which the hyperpolyglots have brains that are built specifically for language learning, which creates this neurological pleasure or enables this neurological pleasure that they have. But your question is about, is the brain somehow working better? The language, my sense is that any language, any new language will be undertaken by the brain in a distributed way, regardless of how many languages you speak, but that with proficiency over time, it centralizes those activities in one part of the brain, specifically in the left hemisphere if you are a right-handed person.
Ooh, interesting, because I'm thinking of my own experience. My mother's German, and I was bilingual as a child, and when it came to learning French in school and Latin, it seemed easier. I could make connections in their languages, like Spanish, which I don't know, but I can pick out words and know them because of their connectivity.
Mm-hmm.
Makes any sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I would want to know, you know, maybe you are someone who has a potentially hyperpolyglot neurology.
Dunka, Ingrid.
Oh, Dunka.
Yeah. I think in the book it's mentioned that there was a gathering of polyglots, and one of them noted that there were a lot of left-handed people in the group. Mm-hmm. Is there any connection?
There's a very interesting hypothesis called the Geschwind-Galliberta hypothesis that actually draws from findings that see correlations between handedness and maleness, or handedness and dyslexia, and some other correlations, also dyslexia and immune disorders, I think. And it tries to provide an explanation for why all of these things might be co-occurring. And it has to do with patterns of fetal brain development, particularly in males.
Hmm. Connor, left-handed, right-handed?
Right-handed, boring.
He's an outlier.
All right, let's go to Carol in Cumberland. Hi, Carol. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. What an interesting show. Thanks for having it on, Keith. My question is whether your guests have, or the author in his research, and also your polyglot other guest, is there a connection between a musical ability with the comfort with learning languages and also learning many, many languages? Thank you.
Yeah, I think anecdotally there is certainly. The one instance that I have to cite is there was another person who went by the name CJ, who said that he could speak a lot of languages and who was given some tests of musical ability and showed not necessarily a high score on that test. I'm sure that there's a lot of other stuff out there linking the two, but I can't really speak to that. I think probably, though, we would say that certainly what you're doing when you're learning language is, you know, a lot what you're doing when you're learning music. You're distinguishing sounds. You're also using your working memory. So you're learning strings of things, sounds that you're keeping in your head and reduplicating them as closely as you can, either with your hands or with your tongue.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. A listener is asking about Rosetta Stone, and if you have any thoughts on that program.
Yeah, you know, use it all. I think, you know, there's not any one method that's any better than another. Or, I mean, I'm not here to sell software for anybody. Some people say whatever method you choose, stick with the method. Other people say, you know, slalom back and forth between the methods. The methods are like medications. Some work for some people, some don't work at all, and some are quite dangerous. So give it a shot.
John in Whitefield. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's interesting. And I realize I'm still learning my English language, the word polyglot. I didn't know until today. But my question, and you guys have sort of worked around it some, But in general, not the anomalies that you talked about of the psychotic person and the other one, but in general, are polyglots of above average intelligence? And then, as you probably know from your research, there are lots of different subtests in an IQ test. So do any of those stand out, like working memory or processing speed or something that might give us more clues?
Yeah, I mean, the cognitive psychological sort of answers, there's quite a lot there, and there's still quite a lot more to be mined for sure. You know, people who are using a lot of languages have very powerful working memories. What you're doing when you speak a lot of languages is you're activating all those languages in your brain, and then you're suppressing the ones that you don't want to use. I don't know about the subtests on IQ test specifically, but on the modern language aptitude test, the ability to analyze patterns is quite important as a predictor for not only very rapid learning of a language, but it sorts out the people who are able to get very, very good.
1-800-399-3566, email talk@mpbn.net, post to our Facebook page, or, hey, send us a tweet. We'll do it all. Let's go to Rainbow and Anton. Hi, Rainbow. Yes, Rainbow. Hi, could you turn your radio down for me, please?
Yeah, thanks. I will do that. Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I was raised in the Netherlands and went to school in the Netherlands, spoke Dutch until I came here in 1959. I've been living here pretty much ever since and am fluent in English. My son was raised here and has been living in the Netherlands for 30 years. When I go visit him in the Netherlands, we speak Dutch. But I find that I automatically switch to English when we talk about things from the past when he was still living in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And it always startles me that I find myself all of a sudden speaking English, whereas it surprises me because it just pops in, You know what I'm sort of saying?
Yeah. Someone had asked earlier about memory, and you know, there's certainly a very strong emotional component to memories, and so you're probably activating those languages that are associated with the emotions of that time.
Pete, go ahead. Sorry.
I think language learning is extraordinarily situational in that people who are multilingual very often are best at speaking one language for one type of situation, namely the one in which they normally use that language, and so forth, and often not quite as good at just suddenly using another language for that same situation. And in particular, as a language learner, what you generally start out doing is trying to pick out the effective key linguistic material for the major situations you're likely to encounter in that language, or just encounter as a general learner of the language, so that. I mean, it's funny. I've known many cases of people who want to learn the language of their boyfriend or girlfriend, but because they got together and got to know each other in, say, English, they almost can't, and they often end up going off to learn the language somewhere else separately from them before they can come back and even begin to talk to their lover in the language. Because the way you – and then I have friends who speak – I have Chinese friends who speak English really well, and I've never spoken to them in English because we got to know each other in Chinese. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, let's fit in one last call if we can. Pete in Buxton. Hi, Pete. Go ahead.
Yes,
go ahead. You're on the program.
I'm sorry?
Yes, go ahead. What's your question?
Oh, I'm sorry. The language that we're talking about is both written, of course, in text and also spoken, and the correct pronunciation is a motor memory process. I was wondering, I haven't heard anybody mention earphones. Earphones are two ellipsoidal reflectors, basically, that you pop on over your ears so that you can hear distinctly what you say with your mouth. And they're being used by a lot of folks from away, for example, Somalia and so forth, to learn proper English pronunciation and that type of thing. I just heard.
Interesting. We've got about less than a minute, so we're going to ask if either of you've heard of these.
Never heard of that. I'd be interested to learn more.
All right.
Never heard of that, but I think what you said about De Keyser, the ability to monitor your own speech by director technological methods is extremely, extremely important to us.
All right. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, Keith.
Michael Erard, author of Babel No More, The Search for the World's Most Extraordinary Language Learners, and Connor McDonough Quinn, Portland native, a linguist, and a polyglot, a lover of language. Today's program, produced by Jonathan Smith, John Keimel ran the board. We had help from Rich Tozier and the MPBN web team. And you can listen to the conversation in previous editions of Maine Calling by visiting mpbn.net and click on the radio tab. I'm Keith Shortall. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Calling.